Hello and welcome to a new episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we select an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Today, I have the privilege and pleasure of talking to Professor Iqbal Singh Sevilla, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, about his new book, The Political Philosophy of Muhammad Iqbal, Islam and Nationalism in Colonial India, published by Cambridge University Press in 2012. The towering Indian Muslim poet and intellectual Muhammad Iqbal, died 1938, is among the most contested figures in the intellectual and political history of modern Islam. Heralded by some as the father of Pakistan and by others as the champion of pan-Islam, Iqbal's legacy is as keenly debated as it is celebrated and appropriated. In his fascinating new book, Professor Sevilla explores Iqbal's political and religious thought in a remarkably nuanced and dazzling fashion, bringing into question the tendency to approach Iqbal through the prism of constraining categories like nationalist, modernist, and pan-Islamic. Sevilla convincingly shows that the dynamism of Iqbal's thought lay precisely in how he traversed multiple intellectual and ideological registers. Iqbal's view of the nation did not correspond to the modern notion of nationalism, Sevilla argues. Through a carefully historicized and conceptually invigorating analysis of a range of Iqbal's writings, Sevilla brings into view the palimpsest of discursive reservoirs that animated Iqbal's thought as an intellectual and as a poet. Sevilla brilliantly examines and displays the complexity of Iqbal's project of comprehensively reimagining Islam in the conditions of colonial modernity, one that contrapuntally engaged Western philosophical traditions and the canon of Muslim intellectual traditions. Carefully researched and wonderfully written, this book will be of much interest to scholars and students of Islam, South Asia, politics, and colonialism. In our conversation, we talked about the problem of nationalist historiographies in the study of Iqbal and South Asian Islam, intra-Muslim debates on the interaction of religion and nationalism in colonial India, Iqbal's agonistic relationship with modernism, his understanding of Islam and nationalism, and the political stakes of this book. Here now is my conversation with Iqbal Sevilla. Hello, Iqbal. How are you?
I'm good, Sherali. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for your time, Iqbal. As I was just mentioning, a fascinating book, a wonderfully written book, and it really is intellectual history at its best. Very philosophically informed historical narrative, and the way that you go through multiple primary and secondary sources and bring the canvas of Iqbal's thought to us. It's really a fascinating read and one that I learned a lot from, and I'm sure our listeners and the readers will also learn much from this book. So thank you so much. And we have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is biographical, where we ask our authors about their journeys, how they became interested in the study of Islam or Muslim societies, and how they became interested in the particular project about which we speak. So I will present that question to you. Could you share a bit about your background and how you became interested in Islam and Muslim societies and how you came to write this particular book?
Sure. Let me just start by saying it's a pleasure to be on the program. And thank you so much for that lovely praise on the book. Much appreciated. Kind of early on in life, had decided that I was either going to be a film star or I was going to be a historian.
Uh-huh.
And it dawned on me a little later that a film star thing wasn't actually going to happen, so I should concentrate on academia. And that's the route I took for my PhD.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the reason I wanted to be a historian at a young age was I grew up in the context of 1984, the anti-Sikh riots, and the Khalistan movement. And it was my ambition to write a book about the Khalistan movement. And so I started reading a lot extensively, and I got very interested in reading about South Asian history. But that was when I was much younger. when I went fast forward many years later, I went to do my PhD. And when I was embarking on the PhD process, I was very interested in examining religious polemics in South Asia, the shaping of religious identities in the colonial period itself, census reports, enumeration processes, but also the content of religious polemics itself. And I was particularly drawn towards debates among modern Muslim intellectuals. And I still remember that when I applied to do my PhD, my aim was to study Islamic political thought in South Asia broadly. And in fact, my PhD dissertation proposal was entitled "The Evolution of Islamic Political Thought in Late 19th and Early 20th Century South Asia." Mm-hmm. Very shortly after embarking on the PhD process, I realized how immature my use of the word evolution was. So that dropped off. And slowly but surely, my supervisors started nudging me to focus on one particular thinker rather than looking at a broad array of individuals. I was a little hesitant about that for fear of the book, or rather the dissertation becoming a biographical project on a figure. But it dawned on me that Muhammad Iqbal presented a very interesting, controversial and interesting figure who could be used to piece together a history of the period itself, because he was involved in a number of debates with Muslim other intellectuals of his time period or his contemporaries. And so it was that element of his debating, his criticizing others and others criticizing him that attracted me to focus on him as the focus of the dissertation and subsequently the book itself. But there was another aspect to Muhammad Iqbal as well, which was the afterlife of Muhammad Iqbal, rather than what he actually is. What I mean by afterlife is the emergence of the figure of Muhammad Iqbal in post-colonial South Asia as compared to what Iqbal was in itself. So this was the fascinating issues that led me to focus on him. But I should also admit that, as you can probably tell from my name itself, there is a parallel personal story as well that leads to Muhammad Iqbal.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather was very attracted by Muhammad Iqbal's poetry. And in the 1920s, he managed to actually meet Muhammad Iqbal once in the Government College, Lahore. And so fascinated was he by Muhammad Iqbal that he would always remember that incident and that meeting. Many decades later, when I was born, and in the tradition of Orthodox Sikh families, I was, as a baby, brought, as an infant, brought to the Gurdwara. And my parents decided to name me after the first letter that the holy text was opened to. And that came out to be an Eri, which is an equivalent of Alif in Gurmukhi. And in between the debates between my parents about whether I was going to be Inderpal, Alvin Jeet, my grandfather intervened and declared I was going to be Iqbal.
Uh-huh.
And ever since then, I grew up hearing about this figure of Muhammad Iqbal. I must admit, I didn't take much interest in Muhammad Iqbal as a young kid. But there was this shadow of this figure that I... So I guess in a way, there's this parallel narrative that brought me to study Muhammad Iqbal.
Wow. Terrific. As a way to begin the conversation about the book, as you show in the book that Muhammad Iqbal is an avidly contested figure with competing nationalist historiographies that present him either as the father of Pakistan or a patriot of India. What do you find problematic in these neat nationalist historiographies, and how does your book bring these nationalist historiographies into question?
Well, the afterlife of Muhammad Iqbal is an amazing topic of study in itself. It's a dissertation topic just waiting to be done as well. As you rightly note, the nationalist projections of Muhammad Iqbal in Pakistan have a life of their own, and selective portrayals of Muhammad Iqbal in India as well. Now, it's quite interesting, if I may just diverge a little bit here, if you compare Muhammad Iqbal to Chaudhry Rehmat Ali, who's actually the person who coined the name of Pakistan, he's not remembered in Pakistan as one of the founding fathers. He's not commemorated in the way that Muhammad Iqbal is. And so somehow the Iqbal has caught on in this nationalist historiography. And in fact, if you just in Pakistan, as you would know, he's celebrated as a founding father, the poet philosopher of the demand for Pakistan. And this links to Iqbal's use of the term nation to describe Muslims. And it's an assumption that when we use the term nation, we refer to a territorially marked political community. And in this book, I argue that that's not the best way to approach Muhammad Iqbal's thought. But just to put perspective, in India itself, Muhammad Iqbal is still celebrated and in some cases abused as well for being the founding father, one of the founding fathers of Pakistan. His poem, Tarane-e-Hind, which is popularly known as Saare Jahan Se Achha Hindustan Hamara, is still one of the most popular patriotic songs in India. In fact, it's been adopted by the Indian Armed Forces for its quick march as well. Both India and Pakistan have competed over commemorating figures like Iqbal. In fact, on the cover of my book, I actually had the good fortune of having permission from the Pakistani Postal Department to actually reproduce a stamp from Pakistan, which was issued in 1990 to commemorate the Lahore Resolution, which was passed in 1940. The Lahore Resolution being seen as one of the founding moments in which the Muslim League starts to move towards a demand for Pakistan. It's a controversial topic in itself. However, what's fascinating about this stamp, this postage stamp, is that Muhammad Iqbal died in 1938, but he's projected as actually being part of this event in 1940 in itself. Why is this the case? It's, like I say, it's because of his use of the term nation, but it's also a historiographical strand in South Asian history, which divides Muslim intellectuals into nationalist figures and separatist figures. And perhaps we can talk more about it if you like to later.
Sure.
In my book, what I do is I try to step away from some such spurious characterizations and move away from the afterlife of Iqbal to actually contextualize him firmly within the time period and intellectual milieu in which he lived. So I step away from the issue of partition, and I even step away from constitutional arguments that happened post his death, so the Lahore Resolution, etc. And that was done deliberately. We're trying to locate him in terms of constitutional arguments that were occurring when he lived. And in trying to examine his socio-political discourse critically, I look at what the term nation meant in Iqbal's usage. And in relation to that, what were the Islamic or Urdu terms that he used, be they millat or qaum or ummah. And I try and kind of piece together what this meant to Muhammad Iqbal himself. I also should add that I try and question this historiographical approach, which presumes not only South Asian intellectuals, but intellectuals in the non-West are incapable of imagining their own political communities itself, i.e. when they use the term nation, what do they actually mean? I kind of try and take that seriously. And so that's how I approach my breaking away from the mold of the nationalist historiographies.
Okay, let me continue this thread of conversation by asking you a broad question, which is, could you tell us a bit about the chief conceptual concerns? You've already begun to talk about them, but if you could further elaborate on the chief conceptual concerns of your book, and what are some of the other problems and tendencies in the existing scholarly literature on either Iqbal or on modern South Asian Islam that your book seeks to redress and correct?
Can I take that question in two parts?
Sure.
In first, the perhaps the tendencies in current historiography with regards to Muslims and politics in pre-partition South Asia. Well, as I noted earlier, Muslim intellectuals and statesmen are generally divided into the nationalist camp or the separatist camp, and this results in spurious attempts to locate spurious breaks in their sociopolitical thought and actions. For instance, Muhammad Iqbal is generally described as having been an Indian nationalist till 1905 and becoming a Muslim separatist post-1905. This is a trend not limited to Iqbal himself. A number of Muslim intellectuals are studied in such a way. So if you look at Syed Ahmad Khan, for instance, he's supposed to have been an Indian nationalist till 1885. And after 1885, which marked the formation of the Congress Party, to have transformed or metamorphosized into a Muslim separatist itself. This is one of the major problems, and it's still these are still categories that are being used as well. But related to that, or emerging from that, is the view that somehow or other the political thought or Islamic political discourse of a number of such figures had evolved in a linear fashion, i.e. you can trace a development from Syed Ahmad Khan's thoughts on Islam and politics to the thought of Muhammad Iqbal and subsequently to Jinnah, and hence the formation of Pakistan itself. So this homogenization of Islamic discourse and Muslim political thought is a big issue, which is being challenged as well now. Related to that is the assumption that there is a normative Islamic political tradition which separatist Muslims had drawn upon. And so that's one of the things I try and peel away at in this book itself. With regards to Islam, the study of Islam in South Asia, there's still and this is perhaps something that relates to wider studies about Islam itself. Islam in South Asia is still sometimes seen as being on the periphery of the Muslim world, that it's receiving influences from other parts of the Muslim world. And in this book, one of the things I try and highlight is a number of figures like Muhammad Iqbal are very conscious of the fact that South Asia has the largest body of Muslims, but also that given their direct interaction with the West in the context of the colonization of India and the exposure to Western educational institutions, they were well-placed to provide a modern interpretation of Islam or an Islamic response to modernity, which could be of benefit to the wider Muslim world as well. So that's another way I try and approach another conceptual issue that I try and raise in this book. And lastly, there's still this use of categories that I found to be uncomfortable, i.e. traditionalist, modernist, or authenticist. These are terms that continue to be used to describe the thought of Muslim intellectuals. And in this book, I try and problematize all three categories and try and open up a space to see what sources Muslim intellectuals are drawing from, but also what they meant when they use specific Islamic terminology.
So you convincingly show in the first chapter of your book that the late 19th and early 20th century, the context in which Iqbal was writing, was a moment of tremendous intellectual fermentation among South Asian Muslim scholars on the question of nationalism and the intersection of religion and politics. Can you describe the intellectual landscape or context in which Iqbal articulated his political thought? And what were some of the key issues which were being debated and contested by Muslim scholars during this moment?
The late 19th and early 20th century was an immensely vibrant period, aided by the rise of or the burgeoning of printing presses as well, the adoption of printing presses at a large scale. Among the issues being debated by Muslim intellectuals were the causes for Muslim decline and the utility of adopting Western institutions or facets of Western civilization as well. One of the things I try and engage with is the fact that modernity, with its rationalism, institutions, imperialism, and ideologies, brought into relief many new questions which forced the Muslim intelligentsia to reevaluate Islamic ideas and institutions. Now, apart from the socio-political context of disempowerment itself, Muslim intellectuals were also forced to respond to Orientalist writings about Islam itself, which were not too charitable in their representations of Islam. Figures like Muhammad Iqbal, Chirag Ali, Syed Ahmad Khan, all leading figures who represent strands of modern Islamic thought in South Asia, acknowledge that their work were direct responses to such polemical writings or colonial critiques as well. And with the rise of or the adoption of printing presses, you also find what can be described as a fragmentation of religious authority, where a number of figures who were not trained in Islamic traditional sciences were writing about Islam. And this, I would argue, leads to maybe what could be described as a very vibrant period of pamphlet wars, in which Muslim intellectuals are trying to provide solutions to contemporary socio-political problems itself. Now, at a level of debates about Islam and the role of Islam and its institutions, one of the first debates that occurs, or one of the major debates that occurs in this period, is clearly about whether South Asia remains a Darul Islam or has it been transformed into a Darul Hub. And this has implications for the nationalist movement as well. Debates were also raging about the importance or the utility of the Khilafat the Caliph as an institution, and the importance of Sharia in a modern state itself. Now, in terms of politics, what we find is if we examine pamphlets and journals from this time period, it gives us insight into a fascinating period in which a lot of Western political writings are being translated and circulated as well. Just to give you an example, if we look at the pages of the Urdu newspaper, Urdu magazine, Paigham, we find that there are numerous articles on the French Revolution, on the concept of democracy, translations of Adam Smith's writings, John Stuart Mill's writings, and of other figures like Locke, John Locke, as well. So this is a period in which we find debates about the utility of adopting Western institutions, debates about the utility of retaining Islamic institutions, all in the process of writings, all in the light of a number of writings about what Islam is, but also about Western political ideas and institutions themselves as well. And what we find is this gives rise to a fascinating debate about what sources Muslims can look back to in trying to answer or in trying to come to a solution to these debates themselves. Whether you could look to the Hadith, whether you could look to the Sharia, whether you could look to, or do you only look to the Quran itself? And this opened up a wider debate about the authenticity of Islamic sources itself. So in a nutshell, it was an extremely vibrant period.
Right. So in chapter 3, you conduct a fascinating analysis of Iqbal as an intellectual and as a poet. And you show that his thought cannot be reduced to binaries such as traditionalist, modernist, and so on, something that you just mentioned, that you're uncomfortable with these binaries. And you also argue that Iqbal's relationship to modernism was much more complicated than what the category modernist would suggest, which I found very fascinating and very informative. So could you talk a bit more about Iqbal's conception of colonial modernity and how that differed from other modernists of his era?
Sure. Iqbal is often described as a modernist intellectual, and one of the things I had to grapple with as I was working on the dissertation and the book itself was, how do I locate Iqbal in the spectrum of Islamic thought in modern South Asia? And the approach I took was to one, look at Iqbal's critiques of other modernists, but also look at how he described himself as well. And there's an interesting incident, a speech he gave at Aligarh, which is celebrated as one of the leading modernist Muslim modernist institutions in South Asia. And when he was addressing the students, he described his message as such. He said, "Mera payam aur hai." The message I bring is different. And he was making direct reference to both the traditionalist, who he equated with the ulama, and the modernist, who he equated with figures such as Syed Ahmad Khan, who called for a rationalist interpretation of Islam in light of the post-Enlightenment conceptions of religion. Well, he critiqued the traditionalist for being unable to draw from modern thought or draw inspiration from modern thought. And he critiqued the modernists for being intellectually captive to the West. And this is how I kind of, this is the opening point where I kind of tried to use to examine where he fits in this spectrum of thought. And what I argue in the book is that if we examine his critiques of modernist figures, we find that Iqbal, in a sense, anticipated later third worldist critiques of colonialism, which saw colonialism as a totalitarian exercise of power, one that extended into the realms of culture and ideology itself. And what we find is that drawing from such an interpretation of colonialism itself, he critiques his fellow modernists for their intellectual thought, for their educational endeavors, but also for their interpretations of Islam itself. And what I mean by this is that his critique of his contemporaries extends, or modernist contemporaries, extends to the realm of art, education, intellectual thought, and also into the realm of interpretations of Islam itself. And with regards to the interpretation of Islam, he's particularly critical of those who, like Syed Ahmad Khan, who seek to interpret Islam in the light of post-Enlightenment conceptions of religion itself. So in sum, what I try and argue is that for Iqbal, like other South Asian intellectuals of his time period, including Rabindranath Tagore, ideas were themselves sources of power, control and domination. And what we find is that the interesting quotations in his poetry and in his prose, where he describes modern ideologies such as nationalism, capitalism, as weapons and narcotics, etc. And this led to my argument that Iqbal should, instead of viewing him as a modernist, one should engage with his critique of his modernist colleagues as well. And this is a trend we find in a lot of his poetry, where he describes modernist figures as being captured by the visions of the West or imprisoned by the grandeurs of the West itself. And he calls on Muslims of South Asia to break that mold of viewing the West as a source of inspiration in itself. Now, I'm not trying to argue that Iqbal's work should be seen as a return to an authentic Islam, or that Iqbal is an authenticist in any sense, because one of the things I highlight is that Muhammad Iqbal's interpretation of Islam is in part inspired by the works of Nietzsche itself. And interestingly, he's drawing from Nietzsche's writings to critique modernist figures who seek to adopt ideologies from the West itself.
Now, among the most productive aspects of this book is The way that you talked about Iqbal's reconstruction of Islam, his the comprehensiveness with which he tried to rethink Islam, and you do it with great philosophical dexterity and in a very multi-layered and philosophically enriching analysis, you show ways in which Iqbal went about rethinking Islam. And you just touched on the question of authenticity. You do discuss ways in which Iqbal imagined or understood the idea of religious authenticity, and the way in which he was very critical of not only other Muslims, but also certain non-Muslim groups for what he considered to be heretical, or that did not fit into his notion of what religious authenticity represents. So could you talk a bit about his notion of what he might have considered to be his notion of religious authenticity and his understanding of heresy in relation to that?
Sure. I must say, I like the way you termed that question, the Iqbal's notion of authenticity. Because the use of authenticity as a term to describe Iqbal is very problematic itself, or describe, and I would argue, the works of Muslim figures in general. Because, sorry. As I highlighted, that while he critiqued modernist interpretations, one should not be lured into approaching his views as a return to an authentic Islam. And apart from figures like Nietzsche, he was also drawing from the works of Marx and Engels, especially their critiques of Christianity, to aid his interpretation of Islam itself. And what we find with Muhammad Iqbal is that when it comes to defining the social, legal, or political institutions of Islam itself, he calls for constant interpretation. He's not so in a way to. He doesn't speak in terms of a fixed code of Islam or a fixed legalistic structure of Islam itself. So this complicates the idea of authenticity being attached to figures like him, etc. Having said that, he does use the term Sacha Islam or true Islam in describing his own interpretations. And he critiques what he finds, what he describes as inauthentic interpretation. So that's why I like the way you phrase that the question in terms of Iqbal's notions of authenticity itself. Now, so what was his notion of the authentic Islam? His notion of an authentic Islam broadly was one that was an empowering ethic or an empowering message, and was a social nizam or a complete system itself. One way to kind of get at what his views about true Islam were was to look at what he described as inauthentic Islam. And here, two strands stand out. The first is the strand that interpreted Islam in terms of a dichotomy between the public and the private, i.e. what I described earlier as the post-Enlightenment conceptions of religion itself. The second strand of Islam, which he sees as inauthentic, are schools of Sufism which prize fana or baka, or loosely translated as annihilation. Now, while the former was described, while the tendency to interpret Islam in light of the public-private dichotomy was rejected by Muhammad Iqbal as being an inauthentic presentation of Islam by modernist figures who were entrapped by ideologies and systems of the West, the concept of Sufism, which stressed the merger of the individual into the one, or the annihilation of fana or baka of the individual, were described as the works of Nietzschean ascetic priest in itself. So these were two strands which he was very critical of. And his interpretation of Islam was in response to such, or his interpretation of authentic Islam was in response to such presentations of Islam. But on the issue of heresy, this was a very interesting issue, because Iqbal went to great extents or great lengths to argue that Islam was a religion in which it was very difficult to be a heretic. Now, Iqbal said that there were only two markers that you had to cross before you were heretic. The first was you had to reject Tawheed, or the unity of God, or Allah. And the second being Risalat, or the finality of the Prophet. These were the only two bounds that he used in his definition of Islam. Now, I would suggest that this was in part in reaction to the fact that he was trying to make a space for himself and others such as him to interpret Islam, but also given the socio-political context in which enumeration and numbers, given the implementation or the introduction of some forms of democracy, democratic government in South Asia, numbers became important. And such, I would suggest that his very broad definition of Islam should also be seen in terms of the political realities of the time as well. However, despite his definition of Islam as a religion in which it's very difficult to be a heretic or to be cast aside for heresy, he does have a controversial perspective on the Ahmadiyyas itself. And it's a very interesting, his views on the Ahmadiyyas are extremely interesting in themselves, partly because he was associated with a number of Ahmadiyya himself. And where he grew up, Sialkot was an area in which you had an important presence of the Ahmadiyya community. So how do we piece together Iqbal's views about or the rejection of the Ahmadiyya with in light of his presentation of Islam as this broad religion? Now, I argue that apart from any theological differences itself, Iqbal's critique of the Ahmadiyya or his rejection of the Ahmadiyya as being un-Islamic should be seen in the light of his fear or his rejection of the view, or rather, let me rephrase that, should be understood in light of the fact that he felt that the Ahmadiyya fell beyond the fold of Islam because of their rejection of Risalat, because they expected a constant they spoke about constant expectations of a prophet. Now, it should be noted here that when Iqbal critiques the Ahmadiyya, he's particularly focusing on the Qadiani branch of the Ahmadiyya rather than the Lahori branch of the Ahmadiyya itself. Now, why is the issue of Risalat of such importance to Iqbal? What I argue is that it's not just about the definition of Islam, but it's also about the empowering ethic of Islam. For in Iqbal's interpretation or presentation of authentic or true Islam, there is an emphasis on the finality of the Prophet, because he argues that Islam is a religion which prizes and accepts the importance of individuality and the need for the individual to struggle and achieve personal development. And this was linked to the issue of finality, because if the individual was in constant expectations of a prophet for guidance, that wouldn't lead to the development of the individual, or the term he uses in his work, which is Khudi itself. So what I'm trying to suggest is that his views on the Ahmadiyya with regards to issues of heresy should not just be seen from a theological perspective, but also as an issue that has socio-political implications. Because in his description of the Ahmadiyya, we find a repeated suggestion that the Ahmadiyya need to be studied in not just as a specific group, but in a longer trajectory of Muslim movements and religious leaders who have sought to reconcile Muslims to a new socio-political environment of disempowerment. And the issue of the stress on a need for renewal of prophethood being a case in point itself. So that's how I approach this this issue of the Ahmadiyya and heresy.
Now, one of the categories that you analyze in some depth and do so with a fascinating discussion is the category of khudi, or the self, or the individual, or the ego, and you show the centrality of that concept to Iqbal's thought. So what is the role and significance of this concept, khudi, to Iqbal's political thought and program?
The concept of khudi is central, I would argue, is central to his construct, his philosophical construction and to his socio-political discourse as well. The Khudi, as described by Iqbal, as translated into English by Iqbal, would be the self, the individual, or the ego. And the Khudi was as I mentioned earlier, the individual or the Khudi was to strive for his development and self-affirmation continuously. And this is where he differentiates himself from Sufi schools, certain Sufi schools of thought that emphasize Baka and Fana, when he argues that the self or the Khudi never effaces itself or it never negates itself, even in the presence of God. Now, what we find is that the Khudi is the basis for the projection of Islam as a religion that empowered the individual and society as well. What he does is he contrasts Islam with Buddhism and Christianity. In his argument, Buddhism negates the individual, thus giving rise to inaction. Whereas Christianity, in Iqbal's argument, recognizes the individual but finds the individual or describes the individual as being too weak to free himself, hence linking him to the need for a savior. Now, this then leads to understanding that Khudi actually is central to his development of this idea of the empowering ethic of Islam itself. Now, I should also point out that Khudi in Iqbal's work is counterbalanced with the concept of Bekhudi, or the force that brings the individual in line with the social ego. Now, in Sufi usages of the term Bekhudi, in Sufi usages, the term Bekhudi is often described as a process of losing awareness of one's self. However, in Iqbal's usage of the term, Bekhudi does not imply the negation of the Khudi. In fact, he argues that it is only as a member of society can the individual truly develop and be empowered itself. I hope that puts perspective to...
Absolutely. In chapter 4, you present an enormously interesting case study of an intra-Muslim debate between two major Muslim scholars in colonial India, Muhammad Iqbal and Hossein Ahmad Madani, on the relationship between Islam and nationalism. And I found this to be very instructive of the larger conceptual stakes of your book also. But the question that I wanted to ask you was, what was at stake in this debate between Madani and Iqbal? And how precisely did Iqbal assemble his argument for the incompatibility of Islam and nationalism?
Now, I should highlight that when I approach nationalism in this book, I don't approach it. Let me rephrase that. When I approach nationalism and the institution of nation state, I don't approach them merely as systems of legal norms or the embodiment of sovereign authority. I approach the nation state as a socio-cultural phenomena, an expression of modernity itself. So, in the process of debating about the adaptability of Islam and nationalism, we're getting an insight to the interactions of Muslim intellectuals with modernity itself. And the debate you refer to is a debate between Maulana Hussain Ahmad Madani of the Deoband school and Muhammad Iqbal. And generally, if I could just go back to an earlier question that you had asked, this debate is portrayed as one between a separatist and a nationalist. So Muhammad Iqbal being the separatist and Madani being the nationalist Muslim figure. Now, in fact, this was a debate about interpretations of Islam and its ability to adapt to modern political institutions and ideologies. Of course, Iqbal asserts that because Islam is a social nizam or a complete system itself, an adaptation of nationalism would fundamentally change the structure of Islam. Whereas Madani would argue that there was nothing in Islam that hindered it from accepting modern political institutions. Now, apart from a debate about the nature of Islam itself, this was also a debate over Islamic terminology. Specifically, it was a debate over which term or which Islamic term could be used to describe political community. And the three terms that they argued over were Qaum, Millat, and Ummah. Now, Iqbal would argue that the authentic Islamic term to be used for political category is Millat, whereas Madni would argue that Millat was a specifically religious category and could not be used for political categories. And instead, Madni argued for the use of the term Qaum. Now, Qaum is a category or it's a term that's used for various social categories, be it territory-bounded communities, race, ethnic communities, and it's also been used for caste communities as well. Whereas Millat is a category that's been used specifically in reference to religion as it is related to a prophet. Now, this what fascinates me about this debate over the term to be used to describe political community, apart from the implication that it has on nationalism itself, is the fact that in using the term Qaum, Madni is essentially looking for precedence for the nation state in the early Islamic state itself. And he's arguing for the view that the term Qaum in Islam has been used to refer to many political categories based on ethnic group or territorial community as well. But given that in the modern period, the territorially defined state is the most important political category, the Islamic sanctioned political category would be the nation state. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to argue is that there's what's at stake is essentially a debate about the nature of Islam, but also about Islamic political categories themselves. And in the course of this debate, both Iqbal and Madni are actually trying to define Islamic political categories. So you have an emergence of a modern Islamic political language itself.
So as a final question on this book, I was wondering if you would allow me to ask you and to engage you on the question of how would you describe the politics and the political stakes of this particular book? And as a way to rephrase it, what resources, conceptual or otherwise, do you think Iqbal's thought might provide us today in bringing into question a territorially bound idea of the nation state that seems to dominate political discourse and imaginaries today? In other words, how do you think we can engage with Iqbal today in rethinking the horizon of the political, so to say, through engagement with your book?
Well, I would love to hear what a reviewer has to say about that, actually. But I would just sum it up in saying that I would make a case that an examination of the thought of figures such as Muhammad Iqbal, and I would suggest going further and that we shouldn't study Iqbal in isolation from the debates he was having with other figures as well, and if we examine Iqbal and the debates he was having, we perhaps can start to problematize the assumption that non-Western intellectuals blindly accepted modular forms of nationalism from the West. And related to this, we could perhaps open up a space for an understanding of alternative political structures, given the discourse, given the contemporary discourse on minority persecutions and failed states that we're exposed to in the media as well. But I would like to add further that perhaps an examination of the work of figures like Muhammad Iqbal would also allow us to engage more critically with Islamist strands of thought. And what I mean by this is that perhaps it's time to study Islamist strands of thought as post-colonial responses to disempowerment. And this is where I come back to linking Iqbal's interpretation of Islam itself with his anticipation of third worldist critiques of colonialism. So I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So as we are drawing to a close in our program, Iqbal, I was wondering if you could share with us what you're working on these days. What are some of the projects we can have the pleasure of learning from and reading from you in the coming few months or years?
Well, I have been enjoying myself working on various projects. As one particularly that I enjoyed particularly was writing about Pakistani Punjabi films. It gave me an excuse to watch films and have a legitimate reason to do so as well. I've embarked, I'm on the early stages of two wider projects. And one is a book on the history of Islamic political thought in modern South Asia. It's planned to be a general introduction to various strands of Islamic thought, ranging from the late 19th century to contemporary intra-Islamic contestations in South Asia. So that's the first project which I'm embarking on. The second is a project that I've been it's been on the back burner for some time, but I finally managed to start work on it. And this is a study of the Mirasi caste, a caste of genealogists and balladeers and bards in Punjab. And I'm trying to investigate how this group that sang genealogies, sang religious songs, but also sang kissas or narrated kissas, came to be relegated in both in terms of their socio-economic importance, but also their caste standing in the early 20th century. And the two questions that I seek to ask are the impact, firstly, the impact of print technology and the development of religious reformist movements on the importance or the socio-economic roles of the Mirasis in Punjab. And secondly, how did the Mirasis view themselves? How did they conceive of their role in imparting kissas and in singing, etc.? And I'm particularly here trying to investigate the idea of history, folk songs, and the inculcation of jazba in the audience itself. So this is a new thing that I'm very excited about now.
The Political Philosophy of Muhammad Iqbal, Islam and Nationalism in Late Colonial India by Iqbal Singh Sevilla, published by Cambridge University Press in 2012. Thank you so much, Iqbal, for your time. It was an absolute pleasure reading your book and chatting with you about it. I really learned a lot from your book and from this conversation. So thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Shirali, and I hope I didn't ramble too much.
That was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Iqbal.
Thank you.
So this was my conversation with Iqbal Sevilla. Hope you enjoyed it. Please also join us next time for another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care and be well.